Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Cheerful Book Club. Conversations with the writers shaping the way we think about our world. Ed Miliband, Jeff Lloyd, and friends spend time with the people behind today's smartest writing. In association with Vintage, read boldly, think differently. Follow at Vintage Books for more.
Hello, in this episode of Cheerful Book Club, we chat to the legend, that is Billy Bragg, about the three dimensions of freedom, which is his pamphlet on the principles that should underpin the kind of society we want to build. Billy talks about the impact of social media and why we need to rediscover how to hold politicians to account.
Cheerful Book Club. Talking to the writers, exploring the biggest ideas of our time. Support for Cheerful Book Club comes from Vintage. Read boldly, think differently. Follow at Vintage Books for more.
Billy Bragg is here to talk about his new book, The Three Dimensions of Freedom.
Billy Bragg is here!
In my attic.
Is this your attic?
This is my attic.
It's not as dusty as my attic, I tell you.
I think behind you on that shelf, there's a copy of the Billy Bragg biography by Andrew Collins.
I mean, I'm supposed to be a sort of relatively silent partner in this interview, but can I just say to the listeners, I've never seen Jeff do so much homework as he has for this interview in 2 years of working together. That is how seriously he's taking this interview.
I'm taking it seriously.
I'm honoured, Jeff. Yeah, I'm honoured, mate.
And it's difficult to keep track because, I mean, you've become a literary factory. It seems just 5 minutes ago you were publishing a book. I mean, you're like Jilly Cooper. It was Skiffle 5 minutes ago, and now it's the three dimensions of freedom. And it's a pamphlet, which there's something almost quaint about the word pamphlet in this.
Well, it is. They do keep using this phrase, and it's not my first. Ed was the recipient of my first pamphlet, and I can remember going to see him when he was but a minion at the Treasury, along with his mate Woody, and talking to them about reforming the House of Lords, as they were the representatives on earth of Gordon Brown. And the representatives on earth of Tony Blair had said, if you can go and convince the Brownites of this, we might get some action. So I thought, well, in for a penny, in for a pound. And
this is the secondary mandate idea.
Yeah. The idea for reforming the House of Lords by just distributing all the seats in the upper chamber in direct proportion to the votes cast in the general election.
So, Ed, what happened?
I failed.
No, it's not true. I mean, you know, it's not sort of thing you can do overnight. I try to engage in politics, even though I'm not always 100% supportive of the Labour Party over those years. I've always tried to engage. I think that's the important thing. If you're going to be an artist who writes about the way the world is, you've got to find some way of engaging with it rather than just writing about it.
And you were saying before we switched the microphones on that these days you think a book is a better vehicle for ideas for you at this stage of your life than a song.
I think it is, yeah. I think it is. I think, you know, I've got to accept that, you know, when I put out a record now, the world doesn't stop and everyone can run over to hear what I'm saying. It's not like it was. Not least because I'm old and I understand that and I'm totally cool with it. But also, music doesn't still have that vanguard role in youth culture where everyone's focused on that. So you can make a relatively big splash. I mean, you think when I was making my first records, there were four weekly newspapers, music newspapers in Britain. So, you know, in that context, you could get an idea out. When I wanted to talk about Englishness, when it wasn't very fashionable, I made an album called England Half English and put the English flag on the cover. So consequently, all the interviews I did were about that subject. That's how I set that agenda. I can't do that anymore. I don't have that. There's no place in our culture where I can make the kind of landing that would have that big splash with a song. but I can with a book or a pamphlet.
It'll get you onto a podcast.
You know, some lovely book festivals out there. You get along, and unlike rock festivals, you don't have to carry no gear. You know, don't get covered in mud. I like book festivals.
So why this book now then? What was just, we'll come on to the ideas in it, the sort of three pillars of the book, but what was going on with you? How long had this been stewing in your brain?
Well, interestingly, when I was coming to see Ed at the Treasury, which must have been, God knows,
2004?
Yeah, maybe, yeah. I was writing about accountability in terms of Parliament, you know, an unelected upper house. So I was already focusing on the ideas of accountability as being lacking in our society. But what's happened in the meantime is the election of Donald Trump has brought the issue of accountability and veracity and honesty right to the centre of our political culture. When you've got a guy who says, I could shoot someone in the face on Fifth Avenue and people would still vote for me. I mean, he's not just talking about I could shoot someone. He's talking about I could shoot someone and be arrested and be tried and be charged and go to prison and people still vote for me.
Yeah.
When you kind of separate democracy from accountability, you know, you really are pushing at the gates of tyranny. So the rise of authoritarianism, not only in the United States of America, but elsewhere around Europe, and obviously, you know, painting a lie on the side of a big red bus and driving it around the country. It seems to me, I keep, you know, once you identify the lack of accountability as the problem, you see it everywhere.
Well, you split it into three. Accountability is the last one. We'll go through them in the order you do them in the book. Liberty, you talk about as distinct from freedom.
Mm.
Can you explain that a bit?
Yeah, sure. Liberty is the right to say whatever you think, to a freedom of expression, to be able to say what you think when you think it, to say it to whoever you wish to think, right? Now, if that's the only definition of freedom we have, then there's no better example of freedom than Donald Trump's Twitter feed, because he's saying whatever he wants, whenever he wants it, with no comeback. That clearly is not freedom. That's something else. That's license he's using there. What you need in order to be truly free, you need two other dimensions to freedom, to create a space in which all of us can express ourselves, you know, have a civil discourse, but also take responsibility for our behaviour. And that's what Trump and people like Nigel Farage refusing to answer questions about his policies. That there seems to be an attempt by people to push back on the limits of social change in the name of free speech. And then when they get attacked, they seem to mistake consequences for censorship.
You use a lovely editor. So what I don't want to do is just quote the book wholesale.
No,
I think people should read the book. But there's a lovely analogy in there which likens this to being on an aeroplane.
Yeah, that's true. Well, basically, because also part of what I'm trying to write about is how we deal with one another online. Because that's you know, obviously it applies to Trump and it applies to Brexit, I want to talk about. But it also applies to how we talk to each other online. And the problem about something like Twitter, for instance, is that makes you act as you would in private in a public place. You know, when you're at home in private, you can sit in your favourite armchair, kick your shoes off, put your arm on the rest, lay back, stretch out. You know, you're in your own space. But if you try and do that in an economy seat on an airliner, you're going to get trouble, because in that context, you're in a public place, and therefore you have to interact with other people and respect other people. And the visual cues you get from that, from looking at the people around you and their behaviour, we're all totally attuned to that. That's how you'll behave. It might be the person sitting next to you wants to talk and is, don't mind moving a little bit. You know, you might see someone across the aisle who's asleep next to somebody, but chances are they're either related or have a very deep bond of trust. You can't expect to just come in and act exactly how you want to. And that's the problem with social media. You're in a private place, personally, where you're sitting writing, but you're in a public forum. And these problems of how I can say whatever I want to say, the idea of liberty, freedom of speech, does have limits. You know, it clearly does have limits, and they work on a number of different levels. A guy was sent to prison for daubing "No Blacks Here" on the door of a black family in, I think, Manchester. That clearly, you can't defend that on terms of freedom of speech. He's rightly been convicted on that. And then all the way back to Twitter, you can say stuff on Twitter and get banned. And that's consequence. You've got to accept that consequence. It's not like you're in Russia being put in prison. That's losing freedom of speech. That's censorship. But, you know, getting turfed off Twitter just because you're constantly making racist, sexist, homophobic comments, that's consequences.
You get into the rise of political correctness as something to be angry about,
yeah,
by a certain type of person. I was wondering, because it used to be a brigade, when PC, we first heard of it, you're part of the PC brigade.
Yeah.
Like, when did you first hear this bandied about, and was it something people would say about
it's
you?
It's a kind of 1990s phenomena, and it's a soft way of trying to limit social change, you know. There really is no such thing as political correctness. It doesn't actually exist. There's no political party promising more political correctness. There's no intellectuals out there writing the theories of political correctness. No one marches on the streets demanding political correctness. It's completely the construct of reactionaries, and in some ways is a manifestation of their lack of power. That things are changing that they don't like, so they try to marginalise those people. And it goes all the way from, out-and-out, really, what is out-and-out bigotry in some terms, all the way to Piers Morgan complaining about vegan pasties. Why would he be so threatened by a vegan pasty, which turns out to be very popular? Greggs are making more and more of them. People really like them. What is that? How does that threaten Piers
Morgan?
You know
that he has just been to the States, seen that gets viewers over there, and he's come back and he thought, oh, well, we'll try that in this country then. I mean, there's no sincerity. There's no conviction in what he's saying. He's just trying to stir people up. But why does it stir people up? Why is it resonating with so many people, do you think?
My sense of it is that it resonates with people who feel they have very little agency over their lives and feel that their lives are controlled by someone somewhere else. If you, as someone like Piers Morgan or Donald Trump or Nigel Farage, can complain about an abstract idea, let's take the vegan pasties as an example, and people can get angry about it, I don't want vegan pasties, it makes them feel like they have some form of agency, and also at the same time prevents them from actually attacking the reason why they don't have no agency, which is because of the corporate control of democracy. That's where the problem really lies. It's the deflection technique.
How different, I was thinking, I mean, you will have both had this. Ed, you will have had it presumably as an MP over the years. And Billy, I'm sure, in the 80s, Red Wedge days.
Good old Reg.
Reg, yeah. How's he doing? How would you get sort of angry letters, green ink letters, and how different is that? How different is that than something like Twitter? Is it just the effort that people have to put in?
It's different in that you don't get 30 of them in 2 minutes,
right?
I mean, if you've ever been the focus of a Twitter pylon, I tweeted something this morning, and I see it's got 96 replies. I'm not even going to read them. Because I know what they're all going to be like. I'm just going to move on, you know, forget it. I haven't got time to spend all day trying to correct people about details that they're totally misrepresenting. So I'm like, you know what?
I'm wondering about the underlying anger, if it's just people have got a channel for it now. Or, I mean, you were on MySpace 15 years ago. Like, how nutty was MySpace?
That wasn't nutty. I mean, I think the real example is the popularity of the idea that the Earth is flat, which has suddenly got a whole new lease of life.
Yeah.
Because the internet is able to connect people who believe that. Before, those people were disparate and they weren't.
Do you not know this happens?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's a huge movement. And rational people are now watching YouTube videos.
You can go on a cruise with like 1,300 people.
What?
To talk about the Earth being flat. And the interesting thing is, this is one of the things I find really interesting, is they all have different theories about why the Earth is flat. But none of them have a theory that explains why, if it is flat, it's being kept from us. What's the reason why we're not?
But isn't that the interesting thing, that people think something is being kept from them? It's that thing again about agency in their lives, right?
Yeah, I think going on Top of the Pops is being kept from me, but, you know, and I know lots of other people who think that as well, but we ain't going to get together and get Top of the Pops back again, are we? It's unfortunately the scope for rational discussion has started to slip away, and that's why free speech alone is no longer sufficient to protect our liberty. It really is, and it's absolutely fundamental. It's absolutely fundamental, free speech. The right to express your opinion has to be the foundation of freedom, because it empowers us. But you have to, when you express your view of free speech, you have to respect the right of everybody else. That's how freedom works. It's reciprocal. Equality is a reciprocal right. So they respect you and you respect them. And then you introduce the third dimension, which is accountability. And what's interesting about that is it is both empowering because it allows you to hold others to account, but it's also reciprocal because you have to make yourself accountable too. You have to accept that some people are going to agree with you. Some people are going to say you're wrong. And you're sometimes going to have to say, you know what, I'm wrong. Okay, I accept that. There's not enough of that either in our mainstream politics or in our national discourse or on our online operations as well.
How easy is it to admit you're wrong as a politician?
Not very easy, I would say, don't you think?
Well, I do, but I think that's the culture in that, you know, the newspapers will call you a flip-flopper or somebody with no conviction. But do you not think people understand it?
Yeah, I think you're right.
But breaking the culture of it is the difficult thing, I guess.
Because a frontline politician, it feels very hard.
Yeah, if you're leader of the Labour Party, talking to him before he was leader of the Labour Party and afterwards is two different things. So I came to see you a couple of times to know what you're leader. There's a lot of staring out the window when he was the leader because he was thinking about, who else have I got covered? It. When it was just me and him talking about ideas, he was like, oh, this is a really interesting idea. I could see how this might work. But when I was talking to him when he was leader, no disrespect, I just got the feeling he was thinking like, yeah, but how am I going to get this passed? The bloke who just brought me in the room and the bloke who's got a pass on the way out. It's the same when I saw Tony Blair. It's the same when I see Jeremy Corbyn. It's not uncommon and I'm aware of that.
Yeah.
I'm coming in at an angle to the debate that's going on. I'm not expecting to be carried out on the shoulders like I've come in, you know. I'm just trying to, you know, put some ideas and float them out there. And I respect people that do the job that Ed does, even as a backbencher. I don't think I would do it because the pressure that they're under, because the effect it has on their daily life and because of the responsibility that goes with it.
I'm really interested, Billy, that you use the word accountability and not democracy.
Democracy, Ed, is not sufficient. You know, how do you explain? We live in a democracy, don't we? What about the House of Lords? Where's the democracy in that? What happened to my vote in West Dorset? Well, the Tories have been in power since 1886, and I'm voting for Labour or Liberal Democrats sometimes, tactically. Where does that vote go? It don't go to Westminster, it goes in the bin. Or those people in Barking, where I come from, where Labour have always been in power, those Tories and Liberal Dems there, their vote goes in the bin. What's democratic in that?
What's your distinction, do you think, between if you had to describe the distinction between accountability and democracy?
Democracy is the opportunity to elect a government.
Yeah.
Accountability is the ability to hold those who have power over you to account. And that's not just politicians, that's also corporations as well and other people who have an effect on your life. You know, it's not just the democracy in some ways is a, you know, the famous Winston Churchill quote, it's the worst type of way of electing a government apart from all the other types that have been tried. And, you know, it has its limitations. Accountability is a concept rather than a mechanism. Democracy is a mechanism. Accountability is a concept.
I mean, it's very interesting because in the start of the book, the two quotes that you have, you are Donald Trump saying, when you're a star, they let you do it, you can do anything. And then the Tony Benn quote, some people will be familiar with, but I think it's incredibly powerful, which is as follows. If one meets a powerful person, ask them five questions. What power have you got? I won't try and do the voice. Where did you get it from? In whose interest do you exercise it? To whom are you accountable? And how can we get rid of you?
I mean, when I heard him say that at Glastonbury, and I heard him say it a few times, but when I heard him say it at Glastonbury, I thought, you know, this is exactly what I'm talking about. That's what this book is about, really. It's all about those things. Where did you get your power? Who are you? It's not just a politician. It's a powerful person. I would argue that it's the lack of agency that has led us to Brexit, that's leading us to authoritarianism across Europe, has led to Donald Trump. People no longer feel that they have the ability to control their lives to the extent that they're not pushed and pulled by the winds of change all the time. I mean, change is speeding up, but people want to feel that they have some say in the way it goes.
So take back control, in a way, is the popular version
of what you're talking about
when you talk about
accountability. Let's not stop with the European Union. Let's take back control of Westminster. Let's have devolution for England. Let's have regional assemblies in England as well, so that people who live in England have the opportunity to vote in an election where almost all of their votes will count.
You know, corporate accountability you talk about also
as well, Yeah, I mean, and that started to, that's a lot more, obviously that's a lot more difficult because you can't really do it on a national level. You need to belong to a multinational group like the European Union, so we're in danger of losing that. But it is starting to come into focus when people are thinking about how we deal with Facebook, with Google, with Huawei. You know, these are all issues of accountability. So although it's not easy to think how we could do this and how do you hold capitalism to account rather than abolish it, you know, there was a time when people thought it was impossible to hold kings to account. You know, the history of England, there's a before and after they chop off King Charles I's head. You know, that's the fulcrum of our history. Before, you know, everybody just made policy through a mixture of kind of tradition and theocracy. After Charles has gone up on the scaffold in January 1649, deliberation takes root. Democracy takes root very slowly, but first, eventually, we're starting to have that kind of democracy. And we need to be at a moment like that with capitalism, where the idea of it just running wild, the new robber baron idea, is changed to a system whereby people have a say and corporations have a responsibility. I think I say in the book that capitalism is like fire. If you tend it, it will give you heat and light. But if you leave it to its own devices, it will destroy everything in its path.
Have you given any thought to what it would look like? You talk a lot about the post-war consensus and the sort of levers and control that the nation state had at that stage. And you use that quote about Tony Blair saying globalization being an inevitability, and you might as well, you know, ask, is it inevitability that winter follows autumn? But have you thought about, I mean, we are living in a more connected world. You mentioned stuff like Facebook and Twitter. What if it's not the levers of a nation state, what does it look like? Is it a version of the European Union? Is it a super revamped United Nations with teeth? I mean,
it has to be some sort of version of the European Union. It has to be some sort of jurisdiction which can deal with ensuring that taxes are paid in the jurisdiction in which they're raised. You know, that kind of extractive model of capitalism that is so common now under globalization. In fact, you could argue it's the point of globalization. Cheap food and no taxes for the corporations. You know, this idea is not a radical outlier idea. It's a lot of people are talking about how to do this. So it doesn't really take a complete change of the system to change the direction in which the system goes. You know, the people who believe in free market capitalism are trying to dodge responsibility. The market will make all the decisions, you know, and if British Steel goes down, it's the market. You know, there's nothing we can do about it. You know, are we going to raise a child allowance? We'll have to see what the bond market say. I heard a Tory politician say that once in a TV studio, you know. So the question then is it just a force of nature, or are the problems that we have systemic, that we've made decisions, people have made decisions? You know, I think the progressive says that the problems are systemic and that we can make better decisions that give the majority of people a greater benefits from the way that capitalism works. And because we live in a post-ideological world, where the language that, you know, we were using in the 1980s, the language that Ed's dad used, no longer connects with people in any way. This doesn't mean the problems that Marx was talking about have been resolved. We've got to find a new language to talk about these. And in order to do that, we've got to find a bottom line. We've got to say, well, how do we build this new, if it's going to be an ideology, what is it built on? I would argue it has to be built on liberty, equality, and accountability.
So what else does equality look like then?
Well, equality looks like Me Too. It looks like Black Lives Matter. That's what it looks like.
So it feels like the arc of history is bending in that direction.
You want to hope that. You have to believe that. If you're going to be a socialist or a progressive, you have to recognise the glass is half full. I don't see how you can be otherwise, you know. If you think everyone's out to get you, I don't see how you can be on the left. Obviously, you know, we're prone to cynicism as anybody else, but we have to be able to kick it to the curb and make a genuine punt to connect with humanity. That's what our politics is all about. So it's nice to imagine that, but sometimes you have to get up on the end of the, enough of you have to get on the end of the arc of history and bend it yourself rather than waiting for it. It's not a rainbow.
Don't you think also we're in a sort of pregnant moment and it, you know, we could end up with authoritarianism, Trump, turbocharged Trump, you know, Trumps across the world, or we could end up with something better. I mean, in other words, there's deep discontent as revealed by the Brexit vote, by Trump getting elected, et cetera, et cetera. But there is a chance to shape it in a way that politics is more dangerous than it would have been when we first
more
met.
Fluid.
10 or 15
it's more
years,
fluid,
but it's also more fluid,
much
and
more fluid,
opportunity, potentially more opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, I think Brexit will destroy everything it touches, and I should imagine the Conservative Party will be top of that list, but Labour could be on that list as well. You know, it could. Everything is shifting in the 20th century. Ideology gave us a framework in which to have a discussion.
Definitely.
And in the sense that when we talked about socialism, we kind of all knew what we were talking about. We understood that. Take the ideology away, things are slipping all over the place. You know, it's like classic right-wingers are now, you know, man of the people fighting the elites kind of stuff. What I would like to think that we could do by focusing on these three ideas is create a new framework which we can bring to bear on people like Farage, or we can bring to bear on what the Labour Party is doing and see if this fits within the parameters of the sort of society that we want to live in. At the moment, there's no attempt being made to make that kind of space. And that's why it's called the three dimensions, because it's a space for a discourse that all of us can take part in about what kind of society we want to live in. That is not ideological. This isn't a left or right wing argument. This is an argument about being able to sit down and discuss these things rather than screaming and shouting at each other all the time and you know, debate being nothing more than point scoring and macho knob measuring. Can I say knob measuring?
Yeah, you're fine. Definitely. You could say cock measuring if you want.
Oh, well, I don't want to lower the tone.
No, exactly. Trust Jeff.
Yeah, that's what I'm here to do. Yeah. On accountability, something I found interesting was the idea of the removal of shame as a tool to hold the powerful to account.
Yeah.
What's gone on there?
Well, I think that's something that has fallen in. I mean, a lot of this is amplified by Trump, obviously. The arrival of Donald Trump casts a shadow right across the landscape of our politics and our discourse. So when before you could put facts in front of someone and they would, you know, feel duty bound to fess up, now it's much more likely they're going to double down and going to try and push through that. Carl Benjamin, with his threat of rape against a female Labour MP, doesn't say, oh, you know what, fair enough, that's a bit over the top, which is what you'd expect a candidate for the European Parliament might say, might show a little bit of shame. No, he doubles down. He comes up with another way of saying it. And that's a very much a kind of like an online mentality, that you don't respond by saying, okay, fair dues. You know, you come back bullish. And I think that idea to sort of like push against a challenge to your point of view is partly an attempt to avoid any shame whatsoever.
What about this as a sort of thesis that basically what Trump has sort of taught people is you should show strength even at the expense of lying? In other words, the thing that always struck me during the primaries was he would never, you know, he'd say John McCain was not really a war hero, and everybody would gasp and say, well, that's it, he's had it, and then he'd double down on it. You know, he'd attack a Gold Star family, you know, somebody who, parents who lost their son, you know, in a war, everybody would gasp, say that was it, and he'd double down on it. And so in a way, and that is speaking to something, which is people feel the world, their own country is in a terrible mess. And they think, in the absence of a sort of ideological alternative, a convincing left ideological alternative, they think strength, they sort of think the strong man is the way out of it.
Yeah, well, that's always a danger, hasn't it? That's always been a danger in terms of our politics. People saw Thatcher as a strong leader. And Blair, in some ways, is a strong leader. I mean, let's don't forget, Blair kind of did up his double-breasted suit and took us into Iraq as a strong man, you know, pushed it through Parliament.
So that was quite unpopular, though, wasn't it?
It was, and Trump is quite unpopular, and Thatcher was quite unpopular.
I mean, Trump is not as unpopular as we would think he should be.
Well, I'm not sure. I think he's the damage he's done to the reputation of the United States of America will live with for a long time. But ultimately, there's a battle going on between facts and feelings. you know, what's in the end, we've got to make a case for veracity, for honesty, for accountability. We've got to make that the bottom line.
But then facts have been undermined, haven't they, by people being dismissive of experts.
That's true, but we've got...
And this, going back to the flat Earth thing, people would rather think something is being kept from them and there's a big conspiracy.
But when it's the flat Earthers on their boat travelling, I have to say it, around the globe with three GPS satellites working out where they are, then it's not even going into it. That's harmless. That's harmless, you know. But when you've got someone like Carl Benjamin saying what he's saying and normalising rape, that is really, really dangerous. So time comes where we have to make a stand, and I'm saying this is where we make the stand.
A last thing on accountability I wanted to ask you about was human rights. Now, human rights are a way of holding governments and structures accountable, and it's become a dirty word amongst the or a dirty phrase amongst the people who it seeks
who to... Who want to avoid accountability. I mean, I'm sorry to keep coming back to this A word, but, you know, the whole thing about human rights is that they belong to the individual. They empower the individual against the state. So the Tories hate them. They hate the idea that they're going to be held to account. Look at Penny Mordaunt talking about getting an amnesty for any soldiers who committed a crime whilst on active duty. That's a war crime they're talking about. We've got to hold a line somewhere on that as well. So human rights are the ultimate guarantor of accountability, of some form of accountability. And we live in a country without a written constitution. So our membership of the European Convention on Human Rights, which currently guarantees our rights to free speech that we're exercising sitting here, is absolutely really crucial, because under our constitution, any government can change the nature of the constitution with a simple majority in parliament. One of the reasons we're in this current stalemate that we're in is because the Tories changed the constitutional length of a parliament and how parliament would, a prime minister would fall in order to keep the coalition together with the Liberal Democrats. And the fact that they could just do that in parliament on a Tuesday afternoon with a show of hands shows you how fragile our human rights are. So not only do we need devolution and elected upper house, but we also need a written constitution.
Well, you know whose fault it is we haven't got one.
It's not Ed, is it?
It is Ed. Gordon Brown sent him an email on Christmas Day 2004 suggesting a written constitution.
That is true, and which I found on my old BlackBerry.
Yeah. See, if you'd taken some time out on Christmas Day.
Hey, listen, tell Gordon to email me next time.
There I was eating the turkey.
Yeah, and we wouldn't be in this.
Mind you, only Gordon would do that on Christmas Day, wouldn't he? Have a break, mate. Jesus Christ.
Billy, there's a lot to feel downbeat about, or even though the book gives us this framework, we're a long way off it. I wondered if we could finish with a bit of optimism. Can you give us a reason to be cheerful?
I can give you a reason to be cheerful. Okay. I can indeed. Okay. Rather than bemoaning the fact that the tide of veracity is flowing in the wrong direction and that the hordes of liars and reprobates are coming towards us, I'm building a kind of, a grass bank of accountability and equality to deal with them. And I'm handing out spears. It's time, you know, it's time to join. We can't sit around anymore thinking, oh, what are we going to do? What we're going to do is we're going to draw a line in the sand on accountability, and we're going to do our damnedest to hold those bastards to account.
Well, get your spears from a good bookshop near you, or get your books from a good spear shop near you.
Either way.
The book is The Three Dimensions of Freedom. Billy Bragg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Cheerful Book Club is produced by Emma Corsham and Joel Pierce for Cheerful Productions in association with Goldfish London. Support for Cheerful Book Club comes from Vintage. Read boldly, think differently. Follow at Vintage Books for more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare.
PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.